As competitive athletes, we live to train for our sport. But serious training can also lead to serious health imbalances. It doesn't have to be this way. My name is Christopher Kelly. As co-founder of Nourish Balance Thrive, I help athletes achieve sustained, optimal performance and health. Now, the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast is bringing this mission to the world, sharing science-based information on the personalized lifestyle changes and interventions that help athletes go faster, feel better, and become truly elite competitors. Your journey to greatness starts now.
Hello, and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name's Tommy Wood, and today I am joined by Dr. Ben Bickman. Hi, Ben.
Good morning, Tommy. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us, or joining me. So for those of you who don't know, Dr. Bickman is an Associate Professor of Physiology and Developmental Biology at Brigham Young University. He has a PhD in bioenergetics and did his postdoctoral work in cardiovascular and metabolic diseases such as obesity. Ben, I know you've been sort of really popular on the podcast scene recently, which has been really nice to see. So you probably have a really great, like, short introduction about you and your work that you can maybe give us to sort of set the scene.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what constitutes as really popular, but let's go with that. Yeah, I'm a prairie-born Alberta, Canada sort of boy, and just long had an interest in exercise. And when I started my schooling as a bachelor's degree student, an undergraduate, I was fascinated in how the body was adapting to exercise and pursued that through a master's degree, but then began to be more interested in obesity, how the body's adapting to obesity. And that's what put me on the path I've never gotten off, looking at insulin and its role in metabolic health. And other than that, I mean, that's my professional career, but I always have to mention before, first and foremost, I'm a husband, father, three mostly pleasant little children, and a delightfully patient wife.
Fantastic. That's a perfect synopsis. And being able to balance both the professional side and the family side, I think, is something that academics do tend to struggle with just because of the workload that comes from doing, you know, basic research and all the things that go alongside that. And I was actually just wondering, so you became an assistant professor in 2011. You're an associate professor now. So that means you must have gotten tenure pretty recently.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So this is, thanks for noticing. Yeah, this is the first year of my advancement. So over the summer, I learned of my tenure and then rank advancement, which is quite wonderful, frankly, because as you know, my research has taken me into this sort of academic black space where, you know, I'm looking at the benefits of high fat, low carb diets, and that has earned me some naysayers here and elsewhere. And so I was a little anxious about that part of it where, you know, am I going to be, you know, blacklisted because I look at the research with regards to low carb, high fat. And it's funny because tenure once existed to help professors have security to then go into, you know, these unknown regions and more provocative research. But it's funny because I've already been doing it. So it's just another day at the office for me.
Can you tell us how the process works for those who don't know in terms of academia and the process of tenureship? You sort of touched on what that means, but sort of how that works.
Yeah. So most institutions, most universities, it's fairly similar. You just have to show a record of productivity in a few different areas. And so for us here at BYU, it's productivity and efficacy in research. So we're meeting a sort of minimum area of how many publications we are getting published per year, and the quality of those publications, how many graduate students we've mentored. And here there's a unique placement on number of undergraduates that we mentor and whether undergraduates are involved in research to prepare them for professional schooling, you know, medical school or what have you. And then service on committees across the university, and then just teaching, adequate output with teaching. And this school is a little unique in that they actually really scrutinize student feedback. And so at the end of every semester, every class on campus, the students are surveyed to basically say, you know, how was the class? How was the professor? And that's looked at for better and for worse. The unfortunate part is if you have a student who didn't do very well, they're going to hate the professor. But on the good hand, it does make you a better presenter and teacher. You do have to find ways to talk about boring things, you know, in a provocative light to keep them awake for an hour or two, however long the class is.
So we met at Low Carb Breckenridge this year, which was when you exploded onto the low carb scene. put it that way. And one thing that I distinctly remember from your talk, which was definitely my favorite of the whole conference, was that clearly, you know, teaching is something that you're very good at because your presentation made perfect sense, but it was also at the right level for the audience. Your slides were very, it wasn't just like death by bullet points. You had like some nice animations just sort of like covering like the important things rather than just trying to stuff a load of stuff onto a slide, or just like, you know, the people who just stick up like the abstract from PubMed or something is like
right.
to illustrate their point. So I think it's clear that that's definitely something that you're really good at.
Well, thanks. Well, it is a challenge. And every time when I'm giving a talk or teaching a class, I'm always asking myself, what's the story? I try to look at it as if I'm telling a story. And I don't want to read a story. I want to tell a story. And so I can tell it best by, you know, it's basically like a picture book, you know, not to insult any audience.
No, I mean, that's true. And we just had a podcast out about a conference that I hosted in Iceland. And one of the speakers there was Sachin Panda, who you might know for his work on circadian biology. Mm-hmm. And he was exactly the same. You know, he's this tenured professor. He's been doing this for decades now. And again, his slides were simple. They told a story. There was almost no text. It was all sort of perfect. So you're definitely on the right track. That was
oh, good.
So going back to your sort of transition onto the more sort of public social media side of health, particularly in the sort of the low carb keto space, was there anything that sort of prompted you to do that? Because there's not many, you know, we have lots of doctors, we have some citizen scientists, we have lots of PubMed warriors who are very good at reading abstracts and trying to create a story that they feel sort of fits what they want to talk about. But there's very few sort of like real academics out on the scene talking about the work that they're doing. So what sort of prompted you to come out and start doing that?
You know, it's interesting that I never realized how unique it would be, but I do have to say, before explicitly answering the question, I have been incredibly impressed with, I like how you describe them, the PubMed warriors, the people that do this out of just pure passion. And I think of guys like Ivor Cummins. These are guys who are deeply familiar and in touch with the science. And by all accounts, they're just as much scientist as anyone. In the end, a scientist is a seeker of truth, and you don't have to have a PhD to do that. But mm-hmm. I really have just gained a lot of respect for this community. I got into this public domain in order to get a book published. A couple years ago, I had written a manuscript that I intended to publish as a book all about insulin resistance. And I was so naive to the process, I thought I would just submit my manuscript to a publisher and they would say, yeah, we want to do it. We'll publish your book. But little did I know, you have to find an agent, and then the agent has to pitch your book to a publisher. And so I got an agent fairly quickly, a book agent. And the agent said, hey, Ben, if you want to get this published, you've got to get out there and get into this. You have to establish a platform for yourself. And that was the beginning of it, just about 2 years ago. And then someone locally in Utah had heard me give a talk about insulin resistance. I give these every few months. I give just free talks to the public about insulin resistance and what to do about it. And a local physician and someone had heard me. And then they wrote the organizers, Jeff Gerber and Rod Taylor for Low Carb Breckenridge, and said, hey, there was a guy here in Utah. You ought to have come present at your meeting.
Oh, cool.
And then Rod Taylor and Jeff just wrote me and said, hey, Ben, could you make this work? And, you know, Colorado is just a few hours drive from Utah. Yeah, so that was the very beginning. And it was such a neat experience. I'm used to presenting research at meetings where it's just a handful of scientists, you know, maybe 100 people in the room sort of thing.
Yeah.
And most of them already know what you're doing. It's sort of, it's almost, I hate to use this word, incestuous. You know, we're keeping the science, we keep the science in the family. You know, the only mm-hmm. person who knows my work is a handful of other scientists, and I'm the only one who really knows their work.
Yeah.
And it would never really leave the room, so to speak. And so the idea of being in an audience and presenting to an audience, not only in the room, but through social media, that had an interest in metabolic research just for the sake of knowing more and being better physically, healthier, that was a very delightful transition for me to go from the dry, purely academic side to all of the rich colors that come with the more public domain and just an informed audience that really wanted to hear what was being said.
That's such a cool way to describe it. And I've done, you know, similarly been on, you know, done the dry academic conference and, you know, done the mm-hmm. the more sort of public conferences. And, you know, that's definitely the case. And you actually get much better engagement from the audience, right?
It's absolutely.
It's not just your competitor who's trying to shoot down your work for whatever reason. It's actually somebody who's genuinely interested in what you're doing. But I wanted,
it's been delightful.
So sort of on that line, I wanted to ask you whether, so obviously you found ways to do this, you know, how do we sort of remove that, I guess, invisible barrier between scientists and the public? Because obviously most scientists do their job, A, for the love of knowledge, but B, because they also think it will help some group of people or the population at large in some way. And previously, the scientists were these untouchable fountains of knowledge who were sort of like hidden in dark rooms, and we had to trust everything they said because they were so smart. But now it's sort of gone the other way, and we tend to sort of think they don't know what they're doing. You know, they publish all this stuff that we don't agree with. So almost, you know, scientists have in certain respects become sort of less well revered, and people are less likely to trust them for some reasons. So how do we kind of bring those groups back together to sort of help scientists show the public, engage with them, you know, in terms of how their work is beneficial?
Right. I think these are great topics and great points of discussion. To me, as I've looked at this kind of almost global phenomenon in what's going on with science and the public perception of it, my hope is that it's not so much as evident, I should say, in the life sciences. It seems like it's more physical sciences and, you know, climate science and all that stuff, which I'm thrilled I don't have anything to do with. But in life science, I've not gotten that perception that it's quite as much antagonistic. But nevertheless, there is controversy, as anyone knows who dips into the realm of diet and metabolic science. It is remarkably controversial. And that is somewhat understandable. But someone has to, when they start to dive into this, what I always tell my students when I show them data comparing low carb to low fat as sort of therapeutic interventions for disease states, you know, for different pathologies in the body, I tell them that they need to, whenever they hear something that they are skeptical of, they nowadays, with the so much of this is available, so much data, so much information, they go into Google Scholar or to PubMed. And once they get a little savvy with searches, with how to do various searches to find the outcomes they want, they can really be incredibly well informed in very little time. But even still, they might find some controversy. And so I tell them they need to scrutinize number of publications and type. For example, an intervention, a clinical trial, will always trump an epidemiological study. Always, always. And it's interesting that in the realm of low-carb research, the epidemiological studies will typically have a negative light or a negative finding, and yet the clinical interventions show no such thing. And so they need to appreciate that. And so that's, of course, what anyone is capable of doing nowadays. Like I said before, becoming a scientist themselves and just seeking truth rather than just being told. It's tremendously liberating. And it's been gratifying to see people, you know, start that journey on their own and to a large degree come to the same conclusions that I came to, because that's what I had to do. A number of years ago, I decided to stop letting the American Diabetes Association or American Heart Association tell me what's the best diet for a person to avoid diabetes and heart disease. And I thought, well, I'm a scientist, literally. I'm going to find this out on my own. And that's when the whole house of cards started to fall apart.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess you came to this through obesity research, and you mentioned the controversies, and obviously, you know, the two broad theories that we have are the energy balance theory, and we have guys like Kevin Hall doing these, you know, very complex metabolic ward studies, doing some complex mathematical calculations. And then you have the hormone theory, that sort of the low carb type people, the insulin, you know, people talking largely about managing insulin. And there's definitely a possibility on both sides that people are sort of oversimplifying and, you know, maybe ignoring some of the better stuff that the other side are saying, when in reality they're both right in various aspects. So do you have a good way to kind of reconcile the two sides and give an explanation of what we think is really happening with obesity and weight gain and then also weight loss?
Right. Yeah, that's it. I mean, there are the two theories of why we get fat. And as you noted, both of them have to be considered. We have to appreciate both. And appreciate that, you know, the advocates of the caloric theory, they're just in a way adhering to that very purist idea that we are perfect thermodynamic machines, that every calorie is going to be stored or used, and there's nothing in between. And that was my talk at Low Carb Breckenridge, of course, just trying to impress upon the people the idea that even, yes, calories will be accounted for in one way or another. And when we embrace the endocrine side of this, of the coin, it ends up introducing novel ways in which calories are, in fact, actually regulated in the human body, all of which are relevant in obesity. And so in the end, I encourage people to always take note. Calorie number matters, but so too does calorie type. In fact, I would submit the calorie type is more important because of this so-called metabolic advantage, that if you're scrutinizing the calorie type and being cautious with calories that are increasing insulin, then you actually have a little more wiggle room, so to speak, where you don't have this sort of hard line above which everything is stored as body fat. That line can sort of shift a little bit. And we see that in studies. David Ludwig at Harvard found that while in ketosis, humans have a higher metabolic rate. And Kevin Hall's research is interesting, and certainly I think it has a place. It's also just really short term. And in a way, like you'd said accurately, it's trying to bring in a mathematical model, which is admirable, because if we could mathematically predict how a human's going to respond to a diet, well, boy, we could really get a lot of research done. And that would facilitate research in the future and, you know, make it more cost effective. But even that has limitations, of course. Be that as it may, the endocrine theory is the one that I think people need to appreciate more, simply because most people aren't even aware of it. They're still counting calories and trying to exercise more, eat less, and do that to get themselves to a better weight level. And that's a paradigm that overwhelmingly often will fail. The person just can't sustain this sort of chronic degree of mild starvation. You know, how many times have we seen, in the US, they have this TV show called The Biggest Loser, where they have these people exercise themselves to just incredible weight loss. And I sort of tongue in cheek joke, how many times have we seen the reunion tour for these people?
That's one of the things that is kind of slightly disregarded, I guess, by the sort of more calorie focused group. And then obviously a caloric deficit of one degree or another is important. But if you're just eating less of the same food that got you in trouble in the first place, like it's really hard to maintain.
Yes,
that, right?
It is.
So
it is.
You've got to make it easier somehow.
That's right. And that's when scrutinizing calorie type, that makes it easier. All of a sudden, you don't have to be starving yourself.
So you mentioned David Ludwig's work. And one of the notable things in the study that I think you're talking to in terms of energy expenditure on a low carbohydrate diet was that those guys were eating a lot more protein, sort of maybe double the amount of protein that the other group was eating. So do you have some thoughts on the importance of protein? And there's definitely a school of thought currently that, you know, protein is going to give us cancer because of too much mTOR, and, you know, people are avoiding protein because it will kick them out of ketosis. Do you have some kind of thoughts on the importance of protein, particularly in terms of weight loss?
I do. Yeah. So the whole phenomenon with regards to cancer and protein, I just don't buy it.
Yeah.
I really don't. It's just so hard. And so I guess this is a case of me earlier claiming I'm only going to let the data dictate what I think. But there is also just a subjective personal opinion component to it as well, when you have to interpret the research and the sum of it on one hand or the other. And to me, the data just don't add up. But nevertheless, with regards to protein and obesity, there's no question protein is a relevant macronutrient. And one of the concerns in this general space of low carb, high fat are the, maybe call them like the keto purists in a way, mm-hmm. the people that anything that kicks you out of ketosis is to be strictly avoided. And that has led some to developing a fear of protein, because different proteins have different effects, but protein is insulinogenic. And if insulin comes up, that puts the kibosh on ketogenesis in the liver quite quickly and quite readily. What people are ignoring, in fact, I've just started a blog post about this. Hopefully I'll get it done in the next week. But what people ignore is what protein does to insulin's opposite, which is glucagon. And protein increases glucagon about as much as it increases insulin. And the reason that's relevant is that not only does that mitigate insulin's effect at body fat, you know, insulin is lipogenic and ketones are lipolytic. And so it's sort of canceling each other out at the level of the adipocyte. But the same thing is happening to a degree at the liver with regards to ketones. And so insulin is inhibiting ketogenesis, but glucagon is activating ketogenesis. And so the end sum isn't as substantially negative on ketogenesis and ketosis as many people would like to think, regardless of what it may be doing to insulin. In fact, in the end, that's quite a magical mix. This macronutrient that's increasing insulin and glucagon, like I said earlier, that's canceling each other out at the level of the adipocyte. But muscle cells end up with a net positive effect, because muscle cells have insulin receptors, so it's getting that anabolic signal of the insulin. Muscle cells do not have glucagon receptors, and so there's no sensitivity to glucagon's normally catabolic signal, And so the muscle just grows, the fat cells don't. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, but it does just, it does represent an interesting paradox of promoting a generally more lean phenotype because of what protein is doing to insulin and glucagon. So my thought is protein is absolutely necessary. And the people that are afraid of it, I don't think that fear is warranted. My philosophy is you just eat protein from real food, and nature usually has protein coming with fat. And so that's a pretty nice combination. And so don't eat a protein powder necessarily, but just eat meat or something with protein. And if it has fat in it, well, then wonderful.
I think that's a, you know, anytime you can get this stuff from real food, and like you say, in general, protein and fat tend to come together in nature, right? So just the same as maybe isolating out the protein could be problematic in its own way, isolating out the fat and having just that, again, could cause some issues. So just eat them together as they come. They're prepackaged.
I think so. Yep.
So let's, you know, talk about some of your own research. And so what you've been talking about a lot recently, and what you mentioned at Low Carb Breckenridge, was your work on insulin and ketones and how those affect the physiology of fat cells, you know, and the differences between white adipose tissue and brown adipose tissue. So maybe you can tell us what you've been working on there and what you found out.
Right. That has been a fun new area of research. And that's part of the fun about being a scientist. If you get an itch, you can scratch it. You know, so this was a question that I had come to with some students wondering about what insulin and ketones are doing at the level of the fat tissue. And there was certainly some research out there already on this. So I wasn't the pioneer necessarily. Well, I wasn't the pioneer. We are just sort of fleshing it out a little more. We've just submitted the insulin part of this manuscript. And what we found with in the insulin case in rodents, people need to be cautious in studies that look at rodents as fed diets and try to make extrapolations to human responses to diets. Those are always problematic. But when it comes to hormones and physiology within a mammal, that's a much more robust and relevant model to human physiology. So I say that to defend what I'm about to say now. We found that when we induced hyperinsulinemia in the mice, but kept their diet normal, we found that there was this very selective transition in how the mitochondria were working in various depots or various sites of fat tissue. And just like humans, mice have mostly white fat. And it is, in fact, literally white. When you pull out a little piece, if you know, when we do a fat biopsy of someone's fat from their subcutaneous fat or their fat right beneath their skin, it's in fact quite kind of yellowy, milky white. In contrast, we have, just like a rodent, a few spots on our body where it's a brown fat. And it's brown. It is, in fact, much more brown because it's enriched with mitochondria. So it looks a little bit more like red meat because red meat has a lot more mitochondria, of course. And so it gives it a distinct color. And more than just mitochondria number, these mitochondria, all mitochondria to a degree, they're on a spectrum of being very, very tightly coupled. In other words, the mitochondria would only be breaking down nutrients or using the products of breaking down glucose or breaking down fat, and it would only break that down as much as it needed to produce ATP to get cellular work done. And so that's a coupled process. However, some mitochondria are uncoupled. They're breaking down nutrients, not because we need a molecule to do work, but just to create heat. And so that's very wasteful, but it's also essential to survival in a cold climate. And it's also very helpful in an environment such as ours, which is an environment usually of excess. And so we found that insulin was stopping mitochondrial uncoupling. It made the mitochondria in brown fat act more like the mitochondria in white fat. In other words, it was telling the brown fat, which would normally want to be chewing through energy just to create heat and increase metabolic rate, it was making them start to slow down, literally slow the mitochondria down and start storing energy rather than using energy. And ketones are doing the opposite. Ketones are not only allowing the brown fat to continue to act in this wasteful sort of high metabolic rate way, but it helped the white fat, a particular type of white fat, the subcutaneous fat, the fat right beneath the skin, it also began to act a little more like brown fat, where it had more mitochondrial uncoupling. That was likely what was causing the increased metabolic rate we see in our rodents with ketones.
So was there a difference in terms of like the absolute mass of fat, or is it just the physiology of the fat that's changing?
No, excellent question. Yeah, the fat itself, the white fat went up in mass relative to other fat pads. The brown fat did not. It stayed the same.
Okay, so yeah, it's because the reason I asked that question is I was talking about your work with our scientific director, Megan, who did her master's work on low-carb and keto diets in mice. And you probably, her paper just came out in Cell Metabolism, showed the increased longevity in mice eating a ketogenic diet. You probably read it. I saw it.
Yeah, and for her, that's a great study. Good for her.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, brilliant work and a great journal as well. She mentioned that in her keto mice, they actually had less brown adipose tissue, or at least that was, you know, when they looked at it, that's what they saw. So are we looking just at the physiology? Is this something that's only relevant if you have lots of white adipose tissue and maybe doesn't change your absolute levels of brown adipose tissue? Is there sort of a way to tie that all together?
So that's a great question, and I'm interested to hear her report on that. We didn't see a change in brown fat, the interscapular brown fat, and that's where the mice put their brown fat, right between their shoulder blades. We didn't see a difference in mass there with ketone or insulin. We just saw differences in the white fat in either case. But in retrospect, I'm not surprised to hear that, insofar as low-carb, high-fat, of course, diminishes insulin, and insulin is what's maintaining body fat. Jim Johnson, who just moved to Novo Nordisk, he has done a lot of research looking at insulin and insulin receptor expression. And if I remember correctly, they found an effect that when insulin receptors were knocked out, the mitochondria were more uncoupled in brown fat. And so more uncoupling, which supports what we found, but there was less brown fat by mass, which supports what you just said, what Megan found.
Oh, so that makes perfect sense. So maybe you have less brown fat, but you have greater mitochondrial uncoupling, and then those balance out, or you maybe even end up with more overall, you have more active brown fat or more ability to uncouple, even though there's less fat there.
Yeah, that could be it. And mind you, that is a relevant feature of brown fat. It's never humming along 100% all the time. Brown fat will be activated or not. We can stimulate, we can turn it on and have it really start chewing through glucose and with mitochondrial uncoupling, or it sort of slows down. And so that might be just what we've seen here, is that, yeah, the lack of insulin results in a relative reduction in brown fat, yet that same lack of insulin and the relative increase in ketones stimulates the brown fat to be more active than otherwise.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Thanks.
Well, we've convinced ourselves at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I guess there must also be a point where there's a negative feedback mechanism, right? Because you can't just keep chewing through energy if you're starting to lose lean mass and, you know, you've created a deficit. You know, at some point your body's going to say, okay, you know, we need to start conserving more than just uncoupling.
I'm not sure where that point is, because you think of an untreated type 1 diabetic, someone who's skipping their insulin injections, or they're undiagnosed, they waste away. And there are, I mean, of course, their body fat just goes away completely. And there is a delightful old report, these old, you know, once upon a time, old research, it wasn't published as individual little journal articles like we have now. It was sort of big stacks, like big, almost like a book. And Elliot Joslin, like the Joslin Diabetes Center in Boston, Elliot Joslin and Francis Benedict were these two early scientists that looked at metabolic rates and metabolic responses in diabetes. And they found that these people who untreated type 1 diabetics, their metabolic rate was higher than when they were treated with insulin. And yet it continued to this, you know, very pathological state of just physically wasting away. And so you'd think maybe that's just too extreme of an example, because there's an absolute deficiency of insulin. And so maybe that's just too artificial. But I don't know where the normal checkpoint, where the physiological checkpoint would be to say, this has got to stop. I suspect it would just come from a person continuing to eat food and always producing some degree of insulin to always keep ketones never going above, you know, 4 or 5 millimolar. And so that's just its natural inherent check and balance, where there's always a fasting basal state of insulin. There's always, in a normal healthy person with healthy pancreatic beta cells, there's always an inhibition on ketogenesis that it can never get too extreme like it is in an untreated type 1 diabetic, you know, when ketones get up to 15 or 20.
Yeah, that's a great point, because so we know that ketones can be insulinogenic if we, you know, in the right scenario. And it may be that if your ketones keep going up, you'll stimulate some insulin production in the pancreas. There is some data that suggests that ketones can inhibit hormone sensitive lipase. So you could almost feed back and stop lipolysis. But then in your example of the type 1 diabetic, that's clearly not happening. So that's maybe not enough of a stimulus to get complete sort of closure of that feedback loop.
Yeah, and that's just, I guess that untreated type 1 diabetes is just too extreme of an example. But your point about ketones being insulinogenic, love it. So this old research in the, I say old, it's my time, frankly, in the mid 70s, there was a couple really interesting studies where they perfused rat pancreas and they would just see what they were controlling, what the pancreas was seeing, and then looking at what was coming out of it. And they found that ketones alone were having little to no effect, just like palmitate, just like a pure fatty acid, little to no effect on insulin. However, when you mix that with glucose, which of course is always present, but there was a threshold that if glucose was, it was something like around, if glucose was 5 millimolar and above, then it exaggerated the insulin response to that glucose, below which it wouldn't have any effect on it. And that becomes relevant to someone who's taking exogenous ketones for the purpose of weight loss and improved metabolic health. If they're taking pretty much anything with the ketones, they're potentially exaggerating the insulin response of whatever they're eating. And so it ends up being a pretty cautious or caution is warranted when we start to orally consume ketones, which may have its place. I'm not trying to poo-poo exogenous ketones in general. I think they really may have a therapeutic role. But when someone's just doing it for a metabolic benefit, I think it's not quite as magical as many probably believe.
Yeah, you've stumbled on my favorite topic of exogenous ketones, which is exactly that.
And oh, good.
So absolutely, I think there's going to be a place where they have a potential therapeutic benefit. They could certainly have a performance benefit, probably the ester rather than the salt, at least based on the research that's out so far.
Right.
But there's one recent study, again, this was in athletes, where they gave them a ketone ester and then submitted them to a hyperglycemic clamp. So they infused them with glucose to look at their insulin responses. And if they'd had the ketone ester first, they basically had double the insulin release. So if you have high blood glucose plus ketones for your insulin, I mean, that's really bad.
Exactly.
And where that becomes important, I think, and absolutely to the point that you were making, is that some of these supplements are being promoted for people with metabolic disease. So if you are somebody with Alzheimer's disease or type 2 diabetes or obesity, and you think that just taking the ketones is going to be enough, if you're not changing the diet and removing or reducing the carbohydrates, refined carbohydrate aspect of your diet, you could actually make things worse, right?
I'm waiting for that study to come out, or I'll end up doing it myself. But it is something that someone has to consider, the person who's doing this. They have to evaluate this. And mind you, there's something profoundly unnatural about that. I mean, in the whole course of human history, we don't eat these ketone bodies or these ketones, beta-hydroxybutyrate or acetoacetate. We don't eat them. We're not meant to eat these. These are molecules that the liver makes. And so we've really created an artificial situation. And I'm not saying that it's going to cause the end of the world, but there is something fake about it. There's something artificial. And then someone maybe could make that case about any number of interventions these days. But in this case, there's just something obviously wrong about it, in the sense that we've never eaten these things before. And so now to try to start throwing them into our diet as some magic pill, boy, as we've already been discussing, it likely will have consequences to the uninformed.
Yeah. And there's also a due diligence thing, right? Now, if you're, they've been tested in athletes and the athletes have good metabolic health, they have a good amount of muscle tissue. But then if you then extrapolate from there, or you extrapolate from the rodent studies and say, oh, this would be great for people with metabolic disease, then, you have to do that study before you can start telling people that.
I agree completely.
So then I know you've mentioned that you're planning to do some work with humans. You're going to do some clinical type studies. Can you tell us anything about what you have planned or what you'd like to do?
Yeah, so I've just started to venture into the realm of humans. It was, in fact, you kind of touched on this, or my thinking, right when at the very beginning of our discussion, you talked about the relevance of interpreting studies correctly. I've been doing, all of my findings have been in cells and rodents, and that's relevant, but it should only ever be used as a justification for then progressing to human research. And that's where I find myself now, is that I'm increasingly frustrated with the limitations inherent to rodent models. And so I've just submitted a protocol for humans, and we've been able to collaborate with a local physician, a local clinic, a bariatric surgery clinic, to get fat samples from humans. And what we're looking at now is determining, this immediate study is to complement the large amount of cell and rodent data that we already have, specifically with ketones and brown fat. We want to look at the role of ketones in fat tissue, mitochondrial regulation in humans, and confirm this result. And so that's the initial study that's just underway now. and we'll get the studies, you know, we'll get the data pretty quickly because it's a good cohort of patients we have access to. But it's just whether or not the human is in ketosis or not, whether they're in ketosis or not, and then looking at the degree of mitochondrial uncoupling in their fat tissue. So that's the immediate study. And then future studies are, in fact, I want to do that exogenous ketone study and look at the outcome of someone just adding ketones to their diet, just saying, here, once a day, just drink this solution of ketones or however much, you know, we'll control for it with a control group. And then just see what is actually happening metabolically. Is there a deleterious effect or is there none? No effect, or is there a benefit?
You'll be incredibly popular once you do that study. And I'll
say it's very I'm sure someone will beat me to it, but it's on the horizon.
So obviously, you know, you talk about translating stuff from rodents to humans, and based on, you know, all of the interactions that you have, you know, social media, all these conferences you've done, do you have some good principles that people can use to sort of, you know, the people that listen to this podcast probably have, you know, they've heard about low carb diets, ketogenic diets, you know, they've probably, you know, some of them have tried them, but if they're trying to help others make simple changes, do you have any recommendations, things that people can do?
Yeah. So this specifically, now, are you asking specifically what could someone actually implement into their lifestyle, or how could they get informed?
Both would be fantastic. So started off in terms of just what people can actionably do, but becoming better informed. And sometimes that's the only way. If you're trying to help somebody else, they need to become informed themselves first before they become interested. You can't just like force, tell them you have to eat this or do this, right?
They need to
move along the stages of change themselves. So both parts of that are very important.
Yeah. Right. So with regards to becoming informed, it really is just this a second kind of warning, a second time I make this warning. A person needs to be, they need to scrutinize what is the model in the research. And if it is any study that's using a rodent, you cannot make comparisons to what the rodent is eating, giving them fat. I mean, you can give a rodent a 90% fat diet, 90%. I don't know of a single human who eats that. I mean, that would be just pure butter. I mean, not even butter. That's too much protein. Uh-huh. That'd be pure ghee and coconut oil. You know, it's so artificial. But you can give a rodent a 90% fat diet and they barely get into ketosis. I mean, their ketones are like 15% higher than the rodent eating the standard chow. It is, I mean, this is just such a phenomenally different response to macronutrients. And so the person always has to be cautious in that regard. And then even be cautious in human studies, and we can't look at studies that just say high fat diet, because a high fat diet is not the same as a low carbohydrate diet. And so a person needs to make sure they're evaluating or appreciating those differences. And so the actual actionable items, I am not a kind of person, despite my genuine appreciation for ketones, I am not an advocate for someone being in ketosis all the time or even ever, depending on the person. I'm not a ketone, you know, poster child here, but I am an advocate of just controlling insulin. And one of the consequences of controlling insulin will be increased ketogenesis and the potential for being in ketosis. But too many times we get too fixated on whether I'm in ketosis or not. And again, that can be beneficial. It may have its place depending on the person, but a person just needs to scrutinize the composition of their meals. And so for me, as a busy father, and, you know, my family is my whole life. And, you know, what I do here at work is just a hobby pretty much. For me, it's how can I make these changes and have minimal impact on the sort of well-being and happy home life of my family. And so for me, I don't have my kids. My kids are certainly more low carb than most kids are. And that just means they eat fewer crackers and they eat more, you know, cheese and pepperonis and whole fat yogurt with berries. That's just more of a staple in my home. We've just been able to set that culture earlier in their childhood so we don't have to make that fight when they get older. But for the person whose family isn't coming on board, which is how I started this myself, I changed my own breakfast and lunch. And then dinner is whatever the family's having. You know, if my daughter, my 10-year-old, wanted to make dinner for the family a few weeks ago and she made grilled cheese sandwiches, I'm not going to push away the plate at dinner and, you know, apologize to my sweet little 10-year-old and say, oh, daddy's just going to eat the cheese from this grilled cheese sandwich. You know, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be very practical and I will knowingly eat a meal that's going to increase my insulin and I'm going to love every bite and enjoy laughing and being with my family. And then I'm just going to get back on the wagon. And so breakfast and lunch are easy to change. because those are meals that don't impact other people as much. It doesn't create a particularly awkward social environment.
Yeah.
And so for breakfast, it ends up being something like, for me, a staple for me is bacon and eggs, frankly. Or I don't drink coffee. I know it's shocking. I'll drink herbal tea and I'll put a little bit of coconut oil or a little bit of butter or something in my herbal tea because I want the energy because I know I'm going to be working out that day and I don't fear the calories. And so anyway, breakfast will always be a low-carb breakfast and lunch will usually be this sort of eclectic mix of low-carb but real foods. It's not foods that come out of a bag or a box. And so it might be a couple hard-boiled eggs, a half of an avocado, and a handful of olives and, you know, a stick of full-fat cheese or something like that. And so I would encourage someone, actionable items, don't worry about ketosis. Just look at your meal and ask yourself, is this a real meal? Am I getting fat and protein in this meal? And usually that's the way real foods come, unless it's, you know, fruit or vegetable, which is great. That's fine, of course, as well, and for the most part, depending on what the person's goals are. But the actionable items, I would say, if there's one takeaway, it's change breakfast tomorrow. Stop eating toast, bagels, and cereal, and go back to the way we used to eat, you know, 50 years ago, which would be more meat and egg based, or just more fat and protein based, whatever that might mean for any individual.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm suddenly reminded of this this brilliant quote, which is, so I assume you saw the Pure study that came out recently. So the one epidemiological study that, you know, shows that basically having a very high proportion of carbohydrates in the diet or restricting fat may be detrimental to health, and that, you know, saturated fat was associated with improvement in some cardiovascular diseases. And so basically they advocated just a more balanced diet, as you might call it, right? Just not trying to overly restrict fat. And the Salim Yusuf, who ran the study, apparently he told his mum about the results. And she said, why did you bother doing this study? That's just common sense. That's what our grandmothers have been telling us to do for centuries. And I just thought that was so brilliant that she could sort of cut through everything and just sort of come up with that immediately. And she's not even, you know, probably not even interested in the whole field at all herself because she just knows what to do.
Yeah. And it's something that I think people need to be more appreciate. We rave about the Mediterranean diet, and yet 50 years ago, that's how we ate in America, in the UK, in Canada. We ate a higher fat diet. The macros, it was about 45% fat, about 20% protein, and then, you know, that 30-ish percent carbs. And even if someone just shifts to those macros, they're going to be so much better off than, you know, where at least the average American is, which is, you know, around 30% fat. You know, almost 10 or 15% less of the calories are coming from fat now. And of course, that's all been shifted to carbohydrates. We have never eaten that way. And so, yeah, like his mom claimed, and any of our grandparents would also likely remember, we used to eat more fat. And that was almost really, it was just because we used to eat real food. It was this shift, you know, from like the 1940s, 50s, where we started eating out of bags and boxes. And that just became exaggerated with the dietary guidelines in the 70s, and it sort of eliciting this fear of fat and this really overblown shift to carbohydrates, which inadvertently resulted in less protein as well. We just need to go back to eating the way we used to.
Well, I think that's probably the best possible summary that you could put together of everything that we've talked about. Is there anything else that you're interested in that you think people need to know that you'd like to mention? Any soapboxes you want to jump on?
In the end, no, and we've covered them all. It's just people need to eat real food and be smart about what they're eating and be very deliberate about it too. If obesity control is the goal, every time the person just needs to really say, what's my goal? But I appreciate addictions are not that easy to control. And carbs, whether people really want to believe it or not, they are addictive. No one's sitting there craving fat and protein, you know, craving a hot dog or a slab of meat, or that's very rare. The average person is craving a cookie or a bagel or something.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this has been fabulous, truly fabulous. I want people to follow you on social media, you know, actually go to your lab and read your research. So how can they find all of those things?
Yeah, thanks, Tommy. The easiest way is Instagram and Facebook. I have a Facebook page, and that's just my name, Benjamin Bickman. And Bickman is no C in Bickman, B-I-K-M-A-N. And then my Instagram is Ben Bickman, PhD. And the same on Instagram and Twitter, I should say. Twitter also, Ben Bickman, PhD. And I simply use that as a platform not to push any of my own agendas, but just to share the latest research usually once a day or once every 2 days, I will just share some of the most recently published metabolic research, just so that people who don't have time to be scouring the literature can very at a glance get the latest reports on health and nutrition.
And that's, I definitely take advantage of you in that arena, if I can say it that way, because how I find social media best works for me is that I basically just stalk people that I trust, and then I look at the research that they post, because then I know that's something interesting worth listening to. So I definitely do that. I'm hiding in the shadows, even if I'm not saying very much on Twitter. So thank you. Thank you very much for doing that.
Great. Well, I'm glad you're using it. Thank you. You're welcome.
And, again, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a huge, huge pleasure.
Thank you again, Tommy, for the invitation. It's always such a treat to talk all things metabolic.
Cool. Thanks so much. Cheers.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.